driver.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. It's awfully good to be in Dayton again. I'm glad you're as close as you are because that means we get to come up here more often, especially when I can export Mr. McCready to an ABC continuing education seminar, which is where he is today in Michigan City, along with Darris McNeely. But in fact, I thought I'd comment a little bit about Ambassador Bible Center. He's up there now working on the continuing education seminar. We just finished one in early July in Spokane, Washington. Aaron Dean and I taught that one. We normally send two faculty members out to each one of the weekend seminars, and we have 10 hours of lectures that are given on the Sabbath because they're Bible classes, and then the remainder on the following day on Sunday. It's in addition to church services, or in Spokane, due to the distance that everybody was driving, we actually folded into sermon form two of the Bible classes, so we had split sermons that served as that purpose. But it's a lot of instruction in God's Word in the course of a weekend. Some of you, of course, got more than that when you came down to attend the continuing education seminar earlier in June at the home office. And that was jam-packed. That was a long, long week of a lot of lectures and a lot of fun. Anyway, Ambassador Bible Center is coming along very well. We have either 39 or 40 students. We just accepted another one yesterday, and I lost count. But our average throughout the history of the Ambassador Bible Center has been 38 students a year, and we have just bumped above the average, which, considering recent events, that we are very happy for that, to be above that. This is larger by a number of students than last year or the year before, so this is a good thing. Another item that my wife and I are busy working on is Mr. Antion asked us to coordinate the ABC alumni. And we've really never had an alumni association, official one, that we actually were running. We will now. We have had three meetings with a volunteer team that are eager to help out with that. So if, for those of you who have attended Ambassador Bible Center or in years past, I think there are at least several up here, you'll be being contacted here before long by the team to get you involved in the alumni activities. We plan to produce a quarterly newsletter for the alumni. We will be doing various projects. In the past, the ABC students within traveling distance of the home office have usually done a fundraiser for the Ronald McDonald House or two during the year. But we plan to make our main charity the alma mater. In other words, most of the activities of the alumni will be to help ABC itself. Plus, occasionally, like that, where we can do a side project to help some other worthy charity, we'll be willing to do that as time permits. But one of the projects that we're going to be doing as an alumni group right away is on, it's a week from tomorrow, actually, we're going to overhaul the backyard at the home office. The patio furniture has not been maintained for years, so it's all rusty. It's that metal kind. So Harbor Freight will yield up about half a dozen brush wire brushes, and Tim Sipes, who's our plant manager or warehouse manager there, as well as our groundskeeper for the facility, will pick up the Rust-Oleum paint, and we're going to repaint those, organize the ABC storage unit that's right there on site. I think we've got plans to do some brush trimming, or rather brush, well, it looks like brush because it's overgrown. Trimming the hedges and the other plantings around the backyard and the side of the building, and also clean the windows in the lecture hall and the dining hall, inside and out. So we're trying to get it spruced up and ready to go for the new ABC class, which is arriving. So that would be a pretty vigorous activity for one of our first projects to actually help ABC itself. The following Sunday, the 19th, is the welcoming picnic for the new class, as they'll be arrived by then. And so we'll have a picnic that the alumni is responsible for organizing, and they're already got that underway. Pioneering is our theme this year. We had a Western theme last year. We liked the activities we did, so we tried to think what could be close to Western without being completely Western. So we decided pioneering would do. So we still get to do rope throwing and horseshoes and fire building and archery and a few other things. Keep the students, you know, get the students mixed around, getting acquainted. Although it doesn't take long, the last year's class was certainly evidence of that. They built friendships very quickly. We already have some of the students who have arrived. Two of the young men from the Northwest came. They've been here about 10 days now, and are all settled in and helping. They've got into the spirit of ABC. They're helping other alumni or students move in. They drove a pickup truck out from Portland, Oregon, so they can help with moving projects, and they volunteered to do that right away. So we're really proud of that. The Northwest, in fact, the West Coast is heavily represented this year. We have 13 students coming from out there in Washington, Oregon, and California, mostly Washington and Oregon. And then the rest of the class is from all over the United States. Plus, we have a married students coming up from Chile. Actually, he's one of the elders in Chile, the Diezes, and Claudio Sierra is coming from Colombia. We had a student from Colombia the last year and the year before, Jaime Selec. He did the second semester first and the first semester second in succeeding years, but Claudio will be here for the entire school year. So that's going to be a big help for the Latin American congregations where they're active. Very big help when they can come back with the biblical training that they'll receive from that. So we are pretty excited about the class that's coming in and are looking forward to getting classes underway. Actually, after the picnic on the 19th, we have orientation on the Monday. They get a tour of the facility and get to hear about the basic parameters of Ambassador Bible Center and the classes they'll be taking. And the classes start bright and early, 8:30 on Tuesday morning, the 20th, 21st. So we're charging forward, anxious to get that underway. As was mentioned in the announcements, jumping now back to the council meeting, I'm the council reporter, so I sit in on everything but the executive sessions to write the brief report. Of course, typically we have a video presentation of almost all the open sessions that if you have the time and you'd like to sit for 3 days and watch them, you can sure do it. This time, I'm not sure how they're going to do that because it's a video conference. Maybe they just take a picture of the TV that we are using for the video conference. That might work. Our main concern is that, as Mr. Rhodes was implying, that the technology functions smoothly. We won't have all of the council meetings. They meet 4 times a year. We won't have all of the meetings by video conference. In May, of course, they're here for the General Conference of Elders anyway. And probably the December meeting, they'll be in person. But if we can do one or two of the meetings by video conference, that will be a significant savings in travel costs and lodging costs. Even though lodging costs we're reducing dramatically because those of us who have extra guest rooms in the home office area normally will house council members or visiting speakers for ABC, visiting instructors. So we're able to take up a lot of that slack, and that's a big benefit. The disadvantage of the video conferencing is we don't have the back channel discussions because you're on task for 4 hours sitting at your computer because that's where your camera is, that's where your microphone is, and then there's no opportunity to talk to anybody afterwards. When they're here in person, there's a lot of time that the council members will sit across dinner table or lunch or breakfast time or into the night, wherever they're staying, discussing all the various things that they're working on, the personal discussions that you can really get into detail and picking each other's minds and trying to find a wise way to go for God's church. So this will be the video conferencing we've got to get used to from that point of view. You don't have that opportunity unless you specifically get on the phone and call back and forth, where you could talk to 3 or 4 people at one time and listen to them, in informal conversation, a phone call, you're going to make 4 or 5 phone calls to get something similar to that. So pray for God's blessing on it, where we have things that we can we can discuss specifically and have done our homework ahead of time. I'm speaking on behalf of the council members, that they do their homework ahead of time, and decisions then can be discussed and then made. It works well. Where there needs to be a lot of informal discussion backing up the decisions, then the video conferencing isn't as effective, but that's why we're not planning to do it for every one of the quarterly meetings. Okay, that's enough, I think, on updates of what's going on. It's just that we're busy as can be. Got a new, exciting vertical thought issue in the works, and I think you'll find that interesting when it comes out. We're getting close to the Feast of Tabernacles. August feast is end of September. It's not that far away, on into October. We're eagerly anticipating it. We were sort of whetting our appetite as we drove for our trip to Spokane. We went to Springfield, Illinois. I did the Tribe Tracker's Guide to History seminar there, Bible study in the morning and the sermon time in the afternoon. And then we went on through to Rapid City, South Dakota, where my folks live, to visit my mother and father and my sisters. That was just two nights and a day we were there on our way to Spokane. Then we drove all the way from Rapid City to Missoula, Montana. That was 850 miles by the time we got to Linda's brother's place. And spent two nights there. And then the Deans rode with us on Friday over the mountains to Spokane. It was only a couple hundred miles. That was nothing by Montana standards. So we had a delightful weekend over there. But as we were going across, we're looking at the fields, analyzing, you know, growing up on a ranch farm operation there in South Dakota for the most part, a little bit in Nebraska. The fields and the livestock and the crops are always something that I watch wherever I go. When we drove across to Springfield, Illinois, the further south we went from central Illinois, the worse the corn looked. Now, that was the last 2 days of June. And in the leaves had curled up tight, and that's stressed corn when they do that, especially when they curl up tight and then they start to turn pale green, not yellow, just sort of a gray-green. And talked to one of the members there in the Springfield congregation who has many hundreds of acres under cultivation, and he was afraid that he would not have a corn crop at all this year. And everything south of there just looked terrible. When we left Springfield to begin our journey on to Rapid City, we got into northern Illinois and the corn looked better. The rainfall had been more generous there. And then further north we got into Iowa, it looked really pretty good. Just your typical occasional dry field that was a little thirstier than the others, but very little curling of the leaves. Minnesota, it was even better. South Dakota was remarkable all the way across. Normally, by the time you get into western South Dakota in early July, everything's tan, except what's irrigated. We had an irrigated farm. That's why our fields would be green, but our pasture would be completely tan, but it wasn't. Even the buffalo grass was green. And that's really unusual in early July. It was still green when we came back in the middle of July on our way back home, because we spent a few days visiting family in Montana and then a few days there in South Dakota. So likewise, our return trip, the northern tier was looking very good, but further south we got, as we came down into Indiana to Indianapolis, it got drier and drier. And knowing that further south than that, it was even drier yet. It had been pretty dry here, as you're well known, until we got our toad stranglers that started coming through with regularity. Is that what you call thunderstorms here, toad stranglers? Gully washers, that kind of thing. We had a variety of names for them. In South Dakota, that's basically all we got for rain. You only got 14 inches in a year. We usually get two of those in 3-inch jolts that lasted about an hour. And just they would just dump a phenomenal amount of water and lots of lightning. And then a little bit would be soaked in drizzly rains, and then the rest was snow. So it's pretty dry, which is why we had to irrigate. So I got to thinking about that, about the coming harvest time that the millennium era, rather that the feast time pictures. And I love to think about how things will be in the millennium. What the economy will be like, what the environment will be like compared to today. So maybe this sermon is more of a whet our appetite for God's kingdom on earth. You know, we know that the kingdom of God is eternal life. I mean, we're going to be in the kingdom of God forever. Not forever, but forever. You know, there's a difference in the way you say the er. But it's always, I don't know, particularly satisfying to realize we get to fix this rotten world for 1,000 years. Working under Jesus Christ as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. We don't just jump into eternity. That's the, you know, theology of traditional Christianity, to go to heaven and that's it. You don't get to fix what's wrong. The millennium is in God's plan because it fixes history. Man broke history in the Garden of Eden and has continued to break it ever since. We get to help mankind fix it. And you say, well, it's not the same mankind. It is too, by extension. You know, we are all connected clear back to Adam and Eve. So we get to help mankind fix the way things have been done. One of the things that will be fixed, we can read in Ezekiel chapter 34, just imagining some of these things that will happen and looking forward to them. Ezekiel 34, verses 26 and 27. This isn't the only place that this particular point is made, but this is one of them. I will make them and the places all around my hill a blessing, and I will cause showers to come down in their season, and there will be showers of blessing. And the trees of the field will yield their fruit, and the earth shall yield her increase. And they shall be safe in their land, and they shall know that I am the Eternal, and that I have broken the bands of their yoke and delivered them from the hand of those who enslaved them. So there's going to be rain in due season, and therefore abundant crops. No more will you see those poor corn stalks, all the leaves all curled and pleading with the sky to send a little rain down. It'll be different. With that, because rain comes in due season, there'll be sunshine. With rain, you're going to have trees. Ohio's a good example of that. Now, Ohio, after the Industrial Revolution rampaged the environment of this state, was down to about 10% forest coverage. Now it's well over 30% and growing. And that's been turned around in the past 50 or so years. And in Ohio, that makes a big difference, because hardwood trees grow here almost as fast as softwood trees go in other places. So we have a far more beautiful state because of that reforestation on a significant scale. You think about all of the devastation of the Great Tribulation. Earthquakes, bombs, wars, you know, all sorts of things like that. And you realize that the world is going to just look like a burned-out hulk to a large extent. So reforestation, in other words, the reestablishment of forests and plains, are going to be vital. Now, it's an interesting point, because I don't subscribe to the environmental do-gooders' philosophy. Their science is awful. Whether it's global warming or whatever it happens to be, typically you find they don't know what they're talking about. The global warming people are exactly the same people who in 1975 said we're going to have an ice age. And they use the same data. You know, they're lousy scientists, with all due respect, such as there is. We have a forester in the church in Oregon. He was retired now from the business, but when he was a state forester, he ran it was a large state forest that a great deal of the education budget came out of that forest for the Oregon Board of Education. And he was one of the two lead foresters for it. So he had to go to a lot of conferences, and of course in Oregon, you know, you have your anti-logging conferences constantly. You know, that's righteousness in the liberals' mind. And there would be a group of young people, usually young college-agers, you know, group meeting usually a couple of hundred. Whenever they were up in Portland, they demonstrate a lot up there. Don't do much else, but just demonstrate. So instead of sneaking around the back of the building, hotel, or wherever this conference was going to be held, well, like everybody else did, he would just kind of walk into the back of the crowd and kind of walk up through there and ask them what they were demonstrating about. There's a Socratic method. You feign ignorance. He knew why they were there, but he wanted them to explain it. And so they would explain that they were, you know, demonstrating against awful logging. And so he started asking them basic questions. I found out they didn't know anything at all about what they were doing. And my daughter said, well, that's no surprise, because at the University of Oregon, where she's an alumni of, they recruit protesters. They're professional protesters brought in there. Go figure. So reforestation will happen on a large scale, and we won't have that kind of a problem. There will be good science, divine science, that will be behind all of this. We won't have the pollution like we have had today. Fresh, clean water will be the order. Fresh air. You know, if we can remake Ohio, let's put in some natural lakes. Somebody make a note of that. We'll make a request when we get around to rearranging things. We don't have a single natural lake in the state. Not one. Every lake you see is dammed. I don't mean it's condemned. I mean that it is. You know what I mean. It's a pond that has been made by man. So I think that would be nice for people living here. Fresh air. Deserts will blossom like a rose. That's Isaiah 35, first several verses. First verse, in fact, of Isaiah 35. The soil will be fertile. The harvest will be great. Oh, that's a great prophecy. Let's take time to read just a couple of verses in Amos chapter 9. Right, the last chapter of Amos. The last part of the last chapter of Amos, no less. Behold, the days are coming, beginning in verse 13. Behold, the days are coming, says the Eternal, when the plowman will overtake the reaper, and the treader of grapes will overtake him who sows seed. And the mountains will drip with sweet wine, and the hills will flow with it, and I'll bring back the captives of my people Israel. And they shall build the waste cities and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and drink wine from them. They will make gardens and eat fruit from them, and I will plant them in their land, and no longer shall they be pulled up. For the land I have given, from the land I have given them, says the Lord your God. The plowman will overtake the reaper. There's such a harvest that before they can get it all harvested, it's already gone around the time that the man who's going to plant the next crop is out there plowing. That's going to be a wonderful day, a marvelous day to imagine. Now, let's think about the structure behind that. The laws that will govern the economy, because agriculture will be the major industry. You think that'll be a dramatic change for agriculture to be the major industry? No, it is our major industry now. Always has been. Biggest industry in America is agriculture. That's why we are so healthy. A little sarcasm there. Unfortunately, agriculture has been perverted in its values, and it is loaded with ignorance of the right way of growing crops, and so that the nutrition is still in the food. It just doesn't understand that. But it will. Well, let's look. What I want to give you then are what we might call laws of environment and economy. They will have implications for the environment, of course, but they will also shape the economy. And by economy, we can mean the financial economy, and the word economy can also be used to refer to society in general. And it's two uses, and is used typically in higher education, used both ways. And by the context, you'll know which it means when it says economy. But let's look at the primary law and I think I have about 10 of the laws that I think are the key ones listed here. Double check that it's 10. No, it's 11. All right. Might have to come up with a 12th. I'd rather have 12 than 11. But until we do, we'll do the 11. And the very first one is the very first one. It's found in Leviticus 25. Leviticus 25, verse 23. Now, as we look at these laws, and just with the setting and imagining what the abundance and the beauty of the environment and of the economy and of the produce and such that we just read about, savor every one of the laws, because you begin to see, whoa, this is going to be a marvelous society that we'll be governing and teaching as we go. Leviticus 25:23. I call this the law of primary ownership. Who is the primary owner of everything? And here it's stated categorically. We can find other verses in the Psalms that say the same thing. The land shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine. For you are strangers and sojourners with me. So the land that God will give the people, which is all the world, ultimately, belongs to God. He is the primary owner. That's a good lesson for us today. Whatever we have, God already owned. We call it ours. You know, I don't care if it's the plastic that, you know, covers your TV or your computer. Whatever that plastic was made of belonged to God, because it all came from the ground, one way or another. Everything is God's. That is the primary law that governs an economy. It is not a law that is followed today, and consequently, we have economies led by people who don't know one thing from another. And we're reaping the bitter harvest of that with the economic problems. The whole world is, not just America, but we're certainly doing our fair share. But the whole world is reaping that, the problems that come from such sins and sinful thinking. To think that we owe nothing to God. Think that we actually own it. No, God owns it. And He owns us. Now, let's go to Micah chapter 2. Micah chapter 2. A little bit of a Bible burn here. Watch your thumbs when you're spinning those pages. It can get hot in this sermon. Micah chapter 4 and verse 4. Yeah. Daniel, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah. I forgot there's one in there. And then Micah, finally, is after Obadiah someplace. If you can find Obadiah, you're doing good. It's only a page. Micah 4 and verse 4. Now, it's interesting when you read Micah 1 through 3, you say, well, that sure sounds a lot like Isaiah chapter 2. Swords into plowshares, spears into pruning hooks, not learn war anymore. Yep, it's almost verbatim. Micah and Amos were contemporaries. And maybe they met over breakfast, and one of them said, you know, I have this thought about writing these lines. What do you think? And he started to read the lines, and the next one would say, between sips of coffee, he would say the next line. Because God was inspiring them both. I'm not sure how it worked, but it worked when you compare that those sections. But it's verse 4 that is the economic law. But everyone shall sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and no one will make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. God owns everything, but He allows private ownership of property. Private enterprise in that sense. And that will affect not only your land, but you know, business as well. Private ownership and private enterprise will strongly affect the design of cities, because here we have the need for there to be land around the homes. So you can have a vine and a fig tree. Now, America is blessed extensively with that in most of our of the nation, but not in the deep into the huge cities. They don't have place for a vine and a fig tree. They're lucky if they got room for a geranium and a, I don't know, whatever you want to plant, you know, a mum. No, if you keep the mum in a pot, but they don't like that very long. Other countries have it even much, much worse, where they jam everybody together in these high rises. You know, you have to have land, a little bit of land around every home. That's very important. It keeps you in touch with the creation. You don't begin to think that everything is manufactured and milk comes from a grocery store. They're wrong. It comes from a truck. See, the truck brings it to the grocery store. But you get the idea how detached we are from an agrarian society. The world tomorrow, agriculture will not only be the major industry, but I believe that it is indicated here that will be a primarily agrarian society. That's not bad. You know, even city slickers, when they stop to think about that, with all due respects. I grew up on a farm, so I was a farm kid. And I went to the city to go to high school. And they were city slickers. And we were country clods. That's the attitude we had toward each other. We're good friends, too. But, you know, it's what we called each other. They were in the big city. I think there was almost 2,200 people in Hot Springs in those days. That was the only town of that size in our county, mind you. You know, you had to go to Rapid City to get bigger than that. And that was over an hour away from the farm. So I think we will be able to see that agrarian society is better. There's a slower pace. There's a chance to appreciate the beauty of God's creation so much more that way. That doesn't mean there won't be cities, because there will be cities, but they will be designed differently. And Micah 4:4 really has a lot to say about how you design your residential areas in the cities. There has to be some land, and there will be private ownership will be allowed, and private enterprise. It won't be a communist society. It won't be a socialist society, as is typically viewed. But it will be, it won't be a capitalist society like we have, where the capitalist society doesn't have checks on how fast the rich can get rich, or how rich they can get, and how poor the poor can get. At least not an effective check. God does. He's got a way to provide economic opportunity throughout the ranks, and then we'll see that as we look at the list of laws. Let's go to number 3. This is called the law of hard work. Whatever your hand finds to do, get somebody else to do it. Nope, that's not it. It's in Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 10. Let us read it. Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 10. And this is, like I said, there are plenty of other proverbs, there are plenty of other statements to talk about hard work. But this one is the one we'll use because it makes the same point. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you're going. Now, the last part of the verse shows that there is not a consciousness after death. You have to wait for the resurrection. So it has a doctrinal implication, but we're looking at the first half. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. God wants us to work hard. Jesus said, where was that? John 5, verse 17, but I might be wrong. It's in John 5, though. My Father works hitherto, and I work. Hitherto is a King James Bible word, and it doesn't get used in any of the others. I love hitherto. I think they should never have taken it out of the, you know, when they redid the translations. Hitherto is delightful. My Father works hitherto, and I work. And we will work. And the people in the world tomorrow will work. They'll work hard. And they'll enjoy that work. God meant it to be enjoyed. And it will be a society that is economically fair. And here is the primary law that governs that. We'll go to Deuteronomy chapter 25 for it. Although there are lots of proverbs that say elaborate on this particular law. Deuteronomy 25, it is stated as a part of the legal code. Verses 13 to 16 is simply this: the law of just weights and measures. The law of just weights and measures. Verse 16, or 13 rather, of Deuteronomy here, it says, you shall not have in your bag differing weights, a heavy weight and a light. You shall not have in your house different measurements, a large and a small. You shall have a perfect and just weight, a perfect and just measure, that your days may be lengthened in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. For all who do such things, all who behave unrighteously are an abomination to the Lord your God. So there has to be fairness. Now, we have laws to be, you know, to give credit where credit is due in America, and I think most modern nations do have laws that govern truth in advertising, you know, weights and measures, so that they're standardized, so that when you go to sell your grain to the grain buyer, he doesn't put in a heavy weight, so you pour in more than a pound of the grain that you're selling. And then he turns around when he sells it to somebody else, he throws a light weight on the scale, so he's only selling 3/4 of a pound and getting paid for a pound. That's lying, cheating, stealing, two-timing, and double-dealing, and God doesn't like that because it's wrong. It won't be allowed in the world tomorrow. There will be fairness. And when you look at the principle of fairness, you can see how then that can be applied in other ways, but just weights and measures are a key element of that, key standard. Now, there is a partnership in concept that is involved. Malachi chapter 3, you can already guess what this one's going to be. A partnership law that helps us and will help mankind, helps us now, will help mankind then, partnership with God when it comes to the economy. Malachi chapter 3 and verse 10. If I get in Malachi, not Micah again. Here we go. Starts in verse 8, will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me. But you say, in what way have we robbed you? And God answers, in tithes and offerings. You are cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me, even this whole nation. Bring all the tithes, the tenth of, you know, your increase, into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house, and try me now in this, says the Eternal of Hosts. If I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out on you such blessings as there will not be room enough to receive it. It's going to be a wonderful time when everybody in the world is tithing and coming under the blessings of God. And we'll, instead of being on the delivery end of the tithes, we'll be on the receiving end in that sense. We'll be overseeing as you know, the spirit beings who are the sons and daughters of God, working with Jesus Christ, will be overseeing the pouring out of those blessings. And that's going to be marvelous. You know, we've seen how God has blessed us when we've been faithful in our tithes and offerings, and at various times in our lives, remarkable blessings. And we're going to see that people also in the world tomorrow will enjoy those blessings. See, but our roles will be reversed. We'll be working with Christ in the blessing department and working with the people. But this is a vital law. Number 5 is the vital law of tithes and offerings. Now, let's back up to some of the more complex laws. Let's go to Numbers, in this instance, chapter 26. Although you can read about this also in Joshua. But Numbers 26. You know, I was just thinking before I give you this one. When you pour out so many blessings that they can't receive it, and you have the plowman overtaking the reaper, and you put all those together, you know, how are you going to eat all the stuff that's grown? And the only thing I can think of is that part of the soil fertility is going to be composting perfectly good food, because you just simply can't consume it all. Now, that's going to be different. Normally, we compost for soil fertility the bits of it we don't eat, or the stuff that got spoiled. In this case, we probably have to throw away, or people will have to throw away perfectly good food, because you think, well, why can't they sell and send it to some place that needs it? Well, because everybody in the world is living this way. It's not just Israel, it's all the nations when we get everything running smoothly in the millennium. And there'd just be so much that they'll just have to throw it out in the compost pile. There goes those apples. There go the oranges. There go the parsnips. Oh, let's put some more parsnips in there. No. That's what I thought when I was a kid. My mother didn't roast parsnips. She boiled them. Oh, they were just awful. The rest of the family ate them. But then I got married and found out that my in-laws didn't boil them. They roasted them. Oh, that's altogether different. So I won't throw too many parsnips away. Nor will I throw away Brussels sprouts. Others might, but I won't. I like them too. Baby cabbages. Here we are in chapter 26. Let's look at this next law. It's law number 6 on my list. The law of land inheritance. We don't have a land inheritance law like this. We have land inheritance laws, you know, inheritance laws in general. You get taxed almost to death as soon as they repeal the death tax, which has been discussed extensively. But this is different. This is, goes even beyond that. Let's look in, it's in verse 52. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, to these, they just taken a census of Israel. This is near the end of the 40 years of wandering. And he said, to these the land shall be divided as an inheritance according to the number of the names. To a large tribe you shall give a larger inheritance. To a small tribe you shall give a smaller inheritance. Each shall be given its inheritance according to those numbered of them. But the land shall be divided by lot, and they shall inherit according to the names of the tribes of their fathers, and according to the lot, their inheritance shall be divided between the larger and the smaller. So it is a law of land inheritance. Here's the remarkable thing about the society and the economy of the world tomorrow. It will be illegal to not own land. That's not illegal today. And most people don't own land, or a great many don't. They don't own much land. Some own enough that their foundation is stuck to it. But you won't be able to not own land in the world tomorrow because of the land inheritance laws. Now, there are several other laws that build on the land inheritance. So let's look at those. They follow forward from it. Let's go now into Leviticus 25 and get into a couple of the very interesting laws that we don't often talk about these days in the church because we are very urbanized. We didn't used to be. Going back a number of decades, many of the foundational members of the church that the Armstrongs worked with across the country and really around the world were in agriculture in one way or another. We used to have Bible studies, farming Bible studies at the Feast of Tabernacles, in almost all the feast sites. But that was clear back in the 60s, less in the 70s, there were a few, and then it began to disappear as many migrated, either younger families migrated to the cities or what have you. But notice this next law is the law of the land Sabbath. We don't talk a lot about the land Sabbath, but we'll talk about it here. And the Lord spoke to Moses, this is verse 1 through verse 7 of this chapter 25 of Leviticus. The Lord spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I give you, then the land shall keep a Sabbath to the Lord. When you get in, got you established, then there's going to be a Sabbath for the land. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather its fruit. But in the 7th year, there will be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land. It's the same language in that phrase there, Sabbath of solemn rest, that is used for the weekly Sabbath for us. The weekly Sabbath is meant for man. God said that the Sabbath was made for man. We need the true rest. We need a downtime. And we need spiritual rejuvenation as a part of that rest. Likewise, the land needs downtime. It needs a 1 year rest out of 7 years of cropping. A Sabbath to the Lord. You will neither sow your field nor prune your vineyard. What grows of its own accord of your harvest you shall not reap. So the volunteer growth, you can't harvest it, nor gather the grapes of your untended vine, for it is a year of rest for the land. And the Sabbath produce of the land shall be food for you, your male and female servants, your hired man, and the stranger who dwells with you, and for your livestock, and the beasts that are in your land, in other words, wildlife, all of its produce shall be for food. In other words, whatever comes up volunteer in your cropland, you can eat it, you know, on at the time, but you can't harvest it. And you're like, well, what are you going to eat? You're going to starve. Well, no, that's all provided for in verses 18 to 22. We better read that too, lest anybody worry. So you shall observe my statutes and keep my judgments and perform them, and you shall dwell in the land in safety. Then the land will yield its fruit, and you will eat your fill and dwell there safely. Notice the spiritual condition of the people affects the produce of their land, because God makes it effective. And if you say, what shall we eat in the seventh year, since we shall not sow nor gather in our produce, then I will command a blessing on you in the sixth year, and it will bring forth produce enough for 3 years. In other words, you'll be able to finish out the sixth year, eat through the seventh year, and into the eighth year when the next crop comes in. So you'll have more than enough. In other words, you'll work your tail off harvesting the sixth year's produce and grain, and then you get a time off. And then I will command my blessing on you in that sixth year, bring forth produce enough for 3 years, and you shall sow in the eighth year and eat old produce until the ninth year. And you've got so much, you won't know what to do with it. So that is a miraculous blessing. The people prove to God that they're going to follow him by obeying the other laws, and then when the sixth year comes in every seven-year cycle, you get a double crop. Not because you planted more ground, it's just that it yielded twice as much. Because God made it do it. Not because of, you know, whatever the seed companies are. I don't know if I should say their names because that might be a copyright problem. But the seed companies, you know, whatever they say. No, it's because God just gave you the double harvest. Okay, so let's think about this. Go back and summarize the land Sabbath law. No crops may be planted specifically for harvesting during that time. Now, maybe you can green manure if you want to. By green manuring, I mean you plant a grass, like ryegrass grows up fast, and then when it gets up and tall, but before it goes dry, you churn it back into the soil while it's green. That's loaded with nitrogen. I don't think you need to worry about that in the world tomorrow. It's a good idea now, but in the world tomorrow, there's so much other stuff you're throwing back into the soil, it isn't going to be needed. So you don't need to worry about that. But you don't plant crops to harvest because you can't harvest anything in the land Sabbath year. No grain may be harvested for commercial purposes, for example. Even though you might have some grain that will come up volunteer, you can't harvest for commercial purposes. The vineyards or orchards will not be pruned. And you're like, oh, you mean I don't have to go out and trim those branches in the cold of winter and wrangle those vines? And he said, no, you don't. And he said, oh, that's really too bad. I don't know if you've ever had to do it in a vineyard or an orchard, but there are a lot of trees and a lot of branches, and they're more than the ones that are in your yard. Yeah. No fruit or vegetables or grain may be stored that were harvested, so you can't harvest any. No hay or winter fodder may be collected into barns on the land Sabbath year. No fresh fruits or vegetable will be available for sale. In other words, you go to the grocery store, and produce manager's been laid off. The poor guy. Because there isn't any produce to sell in the seventh year. Because you can't harvest any. But you don't need to. Because everybody's got too much to eat the way it is. Fresh fruits and vegetables, however, that come up volunteer may be eaten. I mean, the orchard's going to produce. The vines will produce. And you can eat whatever comes up as it comes up from your land, and those who are less fortunate, and there will still be some who are less fortunate, you know, it isn't, you have to work hard, and there are going to be tests and trials that are allowed, as God directs, for people to learn from. So they can harvest this produce, not harvest it, but they can have it for meals. Just go out and get fresh fruit and vegetables. Your cattle can graze on it, the windfall apples, things like that. They can eat those however they want. But you just simply can't harvest it. So everybody can enjoy fresh fruits and vegetables. The produce of the land will be there for wildlife. Now you stop and think about it. Coyotes work like this. When there isn't very much food, coyotes don't have very many pups. Maybe two or three. When there's an abundance of coyote food running around, some with wearing wool and some wearing rabbit fur, and some mouse fur. If there's a lot of that, then coyotes can have 10 or 12 pups. So they expand and contract based on what food is available. And sometimes I think they do it even before they know that the food's not going to be available or is going to be available. So wildlife, when you have a year of abundant food for wildlife, you're going to have a surge in wild bird populations and other kinds of wild animal populations, which will provide very many tasty reunions for families and cats and dogs in the world tomorrow, provided cats and dogs can eat other things. Now, that's another discussion for another scripture. We'll do that sometime. Now, here's an interesting thing. Pasturing cattle, sheep, and poultry will not be prohibited, so that won't be affected at all. So look at the economic implications. Agriculture will be pasture-based. It'll be a livestock or protein-based cropping or ranching, farming operation because there's no restriction on grazing. So grazing can be carried on just as normal. Therefore, it will make economic sense to primarily have livestock. And you think, so how will that be different than today? Drive down the road. What do the farms grow? Soybeans and corn. And soybeans and corn. We are grain monocultures. Well, to be fair, in Ohio, it's biocultures. Bicultures, because there are two. Two monocultures, corn and beans. Now, granted, one's a legume and puts nitrogen. That's what the beans do. Corn slurps it up faster than it can put it in, though. We are at risk as a nation when we have so much monoculture of grain production because we can have a blight or a disease epidemic of the plants that can wipe out a huge section of our food supply. That almost happened in 1971. We had 80 or 90% of the corn growing in America could have been killed by the southern corn blight. But it stopped about halfway up Illinois. That year. It affected about half of the corn growing, and it devastated the crop, and of course those who did have crops in the north ended up getting a lot more for their corn in 1971. That had to do with the hybridization process and breeding out the Texas male sterile cytoplasm. You can look it up, but that's what it was. Corn producers were trying to breed sterile male plants, as I understand it, so they didn't have to do the hand detasseling for crossbreeding the varieties of corn. That's where you get your hybridization. One company or two companies didn't pay any attention to that. They just did the traditional way of hiring high school students to come in and do the detasseling of certain rows of corn and the way it had always been done. What happened was those companies skyrocketed to the lead in the industry, Pioneer International being one. And the others then played a catch-up game for the next 20 or 30 years in trying to recover from that southern corn blight. But, you know, that could easily happen. When you have monocultures, it doesn't have to be the corn blight. It could be other things that could wipe out so much of our food production system. Whereas if you have livestock-based farming and ranching, then it's harder to wipe out one crop of grain, whatever crop it happens to be, because there's a lot more diversification in the production process. Another implication is the land Sabbath maintains true soil fertility, so the chemical, insecticides, herbicides, and fertilizer industry won't even exist. And, of course, with that won't exist all the poisons in the food. And they have generated more problems than they've solved, especially when they try to put Roundup genetically into some of the crops. They are having serious problems that we haven't heard the bottom of or the last of yet by any means. It keeps to seem to unfold every year more and more that we're finding out because of the overuse of the herbicides and pesticides and then the particularly noxious nature of the herbicides and pesticides. A lot of the health problems that are being attributed to some of those things include a rise in the candida rate, yeast infection rate, and many people have lactose intolerance, glucose intolerance, or not glucose, but gluten intolerance as well. Those are just, they seem to go right back to the way we produce our grain, the way we treat our soil. Green grocers, fruits and vegetables, would have no income in the seventh year, so the mega grocery industry won't exist as it does today. It'll be changed. It'll be at a more reasonable size in the cities because most of the population is actually in the country. Every family will need at least some land around their home to provide fresh fruits and vegetables in season during the seventh year. So that'll affect in urban development, similar to Micah chapter 4. And when it says in Isaiah 5, it says, "Woe to those who build house and add house to house," and they're cramming people together. That's a woe. That's not a blessing. That's a bad thing. Well, that bad thing won't happen in the world tomorrow. The cities will be different. It will provide economic opportunity, creative opportunity. I mean, what do you do on the land Sabbath year? Okay, you got to feed the cattle and hay the horses. Then what do? You don't have to plow. You don't have to cultivate. You don't have to plant. I mean, you got a lot of time on your hands. So what do, and then we're talking about everybody has a lot of time on their hands. What do they do? Think about that one for a while. I can give you a few ideas. How about continuing education? You know, the study of God's word and way will constantly be the duty of man and the joy of mankind. To learn more about God and his way and to become more like Christ is. And we're learning that. But boy, if you had 1 year out of seven to do that. And think about this. The law also says, you know, in the ancient times, every seventh year, the entire law would be read to the people during the Feast of Tabernacles. And we think, so when they read their Bibles, they didn't have any. They had copies of the law that were kept by the priest because it was, you know, very difficult to produce them for mass production for the population. So hearing the entire law was done once every 7 years. So it was used, that was in conjunction with the land Sabbath. By the way, the land Sabbath was hardly ever done, nor were the other laws attributed to it or connected to it. Very seldom did that happen in Israel because they were rebellious. But it was meant to happen. So that's continuing education, to hear the entire law read, where you have the law of God all over your house, five or six copies of a Bible, maybe more in almost all of your homes. The average American home has 3.7 Bibles. I don't know what they leave out on that last one. But that's been a statistic. It's been the bestseller book for decades running every year. But to be able to understand it, that's a different story. So you have continuing education, work in the arts, public works, building projects, what have you. All kinds of things that can be used for that. Time for travel, where one family looks after the next family's farm or livestock while they, you know, take a trip to visit some, you know, people elsewhere, relatives, or just to see other countries. That will sew society closer together. Now let's go to the next law, which is also the land Sabbath, but it's another element of it in Deuteronomy chapter 15. This is the law of the year of release. The law of the year of release. Deuteronomy 15:1, at the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a release of debts. And this is the form of the release. Every creditor who has lent anything to his neighbor shall release it, and he shall not require it of his neighbor or his brother, because it is called the Lord's release. Or if a foreigner, of a foreigner, you may require it, but you shall give up your claim to what is owed by your brother, except when there be no poor among you, for the Lord will greatly bless you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess as an inheritance. Only if you carefully obey the voice of the Lord your God and observe with care all these commandments which I command you today, for the Lord your God will bless you just as he promised you. And you will lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow, and you shall reign over many nations, but they won't reign over you. So we have the year of release. Anybody who was a fellow Israelite, bear in mind this was setting as Israel, anybody who was a fellow Israelite in the land Sabbath year, if he owed you money, you forgave the debt. Now, what if he wasn't a fellow Israelite? Well, then you didn't forgive the debt. It continued on. Now, you stop and think about that. We'll reconstitute the tribes of Israel back in the Promised Land, expanded, of course, because there's still, even with the devastation of the Great Tribulation, there's still going to be tens of tens of millions. My guesstimate at one point was between 50 and 70 million Israelites left at the end of the Great Tribulation, after you have 90% have died. So you bring them back to the Promised Land, and you then get them reestablished, then they'll recolonize where they used to be in due course. But there will be a motivation for the non-Israelites. Attach yourself to Israel. Not only spiritually, but physically. People could do that. Gentiles could do that in the olden days. And they would worship the God of Israel. And then they, for all intents and purposes, were considered to be Israelites. So that if they fell into hard times, their debt would be released in the land Sabbath year too. So it's a motivation. You know, that's a better place to be. Ultimately, that's what God intends. Israel was a model nation, and then the other nations will attach themselves to that, both physically, but most especially spiritually through Christ. Now, again, let me see what some of the other implications. I think we just covered those. Oh, there's one extra one in verses 12 through 18. Notice this. Some people get calculating. All right, and I can't exact this debt from you that you owe me. You know, we've got a land Sabbath coming up in a year and a half. I really can't help you. Sorry. You know, somebody who's really in need. God says, that doesn't work. You can't play that game. God sees through it all. If your brother, verse 12, a Hebrew man or Hebrew woman is sold to you and serves you as an indentured servant, in essence, for 6 years, in the seventh year you'll let him go free. And when you send him away from you, you'll not let him go empty-handed. You'll supply him liberally from your flock, from your threshing floor, and your winepress. From what God, the Lord God has blessed you with, you shall give it to him. And you'll remember that you were a slave in Egypt. Therefore I command you today, and if it happens that he says, I will not go from you, well then he can stay. And you have to pierce his ear. Also, in verse 7, let's go back and read the other aspect of the year of release. If there is among you a poor man of your brethren within the gates of the land that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart and shut your hand from your poor brother, but you will open your hand wide to him and willingly lend him sufficient for his need. You don't lend him ridiculous amounts beyond his need, as these credit card companies have done, but what he needs. Beware lest there be a wicked thought in your heart, saying, well, the seventh year, the year of release, is at hand, and your eye be evil against your poor brother, and you give him nothing. For he'll cry out to the Lord against you, and it will be a sin among you. And you shall surely give to him, and your heart will not be grieved when you give to him, because for this thing the Lord your God will bless you in all your works, and in all to which you put your hand. For the poor will never cease from the land. Therefore I command you, saying, you shall be open your hand wide to your brother, and your poor and your needy in your land. In other words, you don't get calculating, you be generous. If you're generous, God will be generous with you. You know that works today. If we give generously, helping others, you know, dedicating ourselves to, you know, further the cause of the work of God as well, because that's helping others in the ultimate spiritual way, God will be generous with us. And he has his hand on the spigot. He can turn it down. He can turn it up. And the flow of blessings are all up to God. And so the year of release will provide wonderful economic implications. So again, it's on the seven-year cycle. So we have debt being forgiven regularly. It nips in the bud the specter of long-term debt and never getting out of the hole. It creates a positive societal mood and mindset. The generosity of the rich toward the poor. Economic wisdom guided by indentured servanthood. When somebody has to sell themselves to serve somebody else. You know, in other words, okay, would you just buy my labor and I'll work for you until, you know, for the next 6 years. That's a good time for him to be mentored in wise use of his resources, if that's what he needs. You know, some people, it might be for some other reason, but mostly it's that. Family stability will be maintained by indentured servanthood, which is all a part of the year of release, because they won't be grindingly poor and not be able to provide for their children, because a more wealthy neighbor or in the community will take them under his wing and provide for them. So they'll have the food, they'll have the shelter, they'll have the basic things they need and work to do. And it's an opportunity, therefore, for the rich to serve the poor. That breaks down class envy. Plus, it provides national and individual economic blessings promised for obedience. And it provides economic opportunity. The debt is forgiven. You think, well, don't we have something like that? We do. It's called bankruptcy laws. Bankruptcy laws are a facsimile, a fuzzy one, mind you, but at least a facsimile of the year of release and also the Jubilee year. So our bankruptcy laws are sort of based on that principle. And in fact, the next law, number 9, is the law of the Jubilee year. Let's look in Deuteronomy, or rather Leviticus 25 again, because that's where the Jubilee comes in. Beginning in verse 8 of chapter 25 of Leviticus. And you shall count 7 Sabbaths of years for yourself, 7 times 7 years, and the time of the 7 Sabbaths of years shall be to you 49 years. So you count 49 years, and then you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement. Wouldn't you like to be the one that has to blow the trumpet on the Day of Atonement? We had a strange thing. Years ago, we pastored in Wisconsin and Illinois. And on the holy days, we had a huge orchestra, a 30 or 35-piece orchestra and a 38-voice choir in our Rockford congregation. Out of 165 people, we had 60 or 70 of them that were in special music. And then when we combined with the congregation from Janesville, Wisconsin, which was the northern end of our circuit, it was a little bit, just a tiny bit smaller congregation. But then you'd add another 10 to the orchestra and another 20 to the choir. So on special music days, the hall would tip forward when everybody went up to do special music on holy days. You know, we'd have the big show, as we called it, when we had everybody performing. And I told our elder who coordinated all that, I said, you know, they don't have to do that on the Day of Atonement. We could just have a solo or a piano piece for the special music on the offertory. He said, no, no, they like to do it on the Day of Atonement. I said, are you kidding? Yeah, they love it. They like to sing and they like to play their instruments. And they did. I guess it kept the mind off the fact that they were hungry. And, you know, they did. They loved to do it on the Day of Atonement. So it won't be a chore. It'll be a blessing for whoever gets to blow the trumpet. But notice that the agricultural year ends and begins on the Day of Atonement. Not on the Feast of Trumpets, what the Jews call their sort of commercial year, the Rosh Hashanah, their Jewish New Year. And it doesn't begin in the spring. It begins in the fall. Now, if you're a farmer, you know that. If you're going to switch, you're going to move from one farm to another farm, you do it in the fall. As soon as you're done with the harvest, you beat it over there so you'll be all ready to plant in the spring. So the agricultural year ended and began on the Day of Atonement. The sacred year began in the spring, 2 weeks before Passover, as we already know. So the land Sabbath, or the Jubilee, would begin on the Day of Atonement. If the Jubilee began on the Day of Atonement, and you counted 7 Sabbaths of 7 years of 7 Sabbaths of years to get to it, then that also means that the land Sabbath began on the Day of Atonement and ended on the Day of Atonement. But there's one other thing that began on the Day of Atonement. The third tithe year. Now, in the third tithe year, some assume, well, it's every third year. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and so on. No, it's 1, 2, 3 is your third tithe year. 4, 5, 6 is the third tithe year. Then you have a land Sabbath. Then you start counting again. 1, 2, 3 is the third tithe year. 4, 5, 6 is the third tithe year. And then a land Sabbath. In other words, the land Sabbath isn't in the 1, 2, 3 sequence. So it's not quite a waltz. Not quite a waltz. And the reason is this. If you just did 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, you'd end up with a land Sabbath being the third tithe year in the 21st year. Well, that doesn't work because there's no big harvest then. So it has to be the third and the sixth year in the seven-year cycle. And it began and it ended on the Day of Atonement. So it was all those were tied together. Now, let's go on and read about that. The tenth day of the seventh month, the Day of Atonement, you shall make the trumpet to sound throughout your land. You shall consecrate the 50th year, which begins at the end of the 49th year, and proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all its inhabitants. It will be a jubilee for you. Each of you will return to his possession. So the land that your family inherited, that was sold, comes back to you. In other words, it cannot be sold in perpetuity. The home place can't be sold. Perpetuity is a real estate term, forever. It can only be sold until the Jubilee year. In other words, you prorate, and it goes to explain this, you prorate how many harvest years are left up till the Jubilee, and that's what the land is worth. You know, if it's 49 of them, then you get the full price. If it's only 30 years to it, then it's going to be less. So it's a law, it's like buying a long-term lease, somebody that isn't going to lease it all the way. So it comes back to the family, and each of you will return to his family. So you also have other types of indentured servanthood that will, you know, be freed up so people can go back to their families. It's going to be a marvelous time. Did I get through all the way to verse 17? No, I haven't. Each will return to his possession, each to his family. The 50th year will be a jubilee for you, in verse 11. And you'll neither sow nor reap what grows of its own accord, nor gather in the grapes of your untended vine. So it's a double land Sabbath, and it is a jubilee. It'll be holy to you, and you'll eat the produce of the field. In other words, whatever comes up, you can eat when it's fresh. In this year of jubilee, each of you will return to his possession, and each, if you sell anything to your neighbor or buy from your neighbor's hand, you shall not oppress one another. According to the number of years after the jubilee, you shall buy from your neighbor, and according to the number of crops, he shall sell it to you. According to the multitude of years, you will increase its price. According to the fewer number of years, you will diminish its price, for he sells to you according to the number of the years of the crops. Therefore, you shall not oppress one another, but you shall fear the Lord your God, for I am the Eternal your God. In other words, you will be fair. Fair and even generous with each other. That will be, you imagine a society where everybody is trying to be fair and generous with everybody else. That's a lot different than today. And it's going to be marvelous. And we get to preside over it. We get to teach it. We get to watch it flourish. And then it won't need as much tutoring and as much guidance because it will pick up a momentum on its own. It will be marvelous to watch and to serve under Christ as we help to bring about fixing how crooked our world has become. This is just another part of it. Then down in I think that covered all of it. All the Jubilee year. No, hold it. No, I didn't. Verse 23. I was looking at the wrong reference. Verse 23. We pick it up again, what we read before. The land will be not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. You are strangers and sojourners with me. That was law number one, the law of primary ownership. And if one of your brother becomes poor and has sold his possession, and his redeeming relative comes to redeem it, or he may redeem what his brother sold. Or if the man has no one to redeem it, then he himself shall redeem it. Then let him count the years since its sale and restore the remainder. In other words, you can always buy back your land. If you decide, I can't afford the farm, I'm going to sell my land, you know, until the Jubilee, you can always redeem it if you change your mind. Always. Now, it goes on to say that the same applies to homes in a village, the agricultural home. But it doesn't apply to city, you know, buildings in a city, you know, like houses in a city. However, there is a redemption law even there. And that's all in this section here. If you had a house in the city and you sold it, you can choose to redeem it at any time within a year. Otherwise, it's a finalized sale. And you thought, well, hold it. Now, that's going to change real estate dealings quite a bit. So you buy a place from somebody, but they could come back and buy it back anytime they want, up to a year, just, you know, in the city. In the country, they can always come back and redeem it. So it makes you look at the land differently than you do now. And you realize you can't be selfish about this. you know, this could be theirs if they can find the funds and they can come back and buy it back from me. And that will be good. God will bless us both. It's just the way that God has set it up. So just a quick summary of the Jubilee year. It's sequenced with a land Sabbath, and as I said, the third tithe year. It's also a land Sabbath, a year of celebration, families returning to their inheritance possession, the land inheritance, liberty proclaimed through the land, including economic freedom. See, what the Jubilee does, when the land comes back to the family of origin, you just had an economic boon handed to you. And you get to decide what to do with it. And you'd rather make shoes in town? Okay, everybody needs shoes. So you can sell it out to somebody else until the next Jubilee year. But you have an infusion of economic opportunity, of funds. One way or the other. Either you have the land or you have the money from the land. So you have money moving back and forth in a natural ebb and flow over time within the society. You don't have the rich getting ridiculously rich and the poor getting grindingly poor. You have opportunity for the poor and a balance on the rich so that we don't end up with what we have today. That'll be a good thing. The economic opportunity moving back and forth. Then you don't have to have depressions and severe recessions. See, that also re-stirs the pot. Resets the economic clock for millions and millions of people, but very traumatically. God's way is not traumatic. It's planned for. It's expected. It's anticipated. It is celebrated. That's a whole different kettle of fish than what we have today in our economic situations. Some of the implications will be, again, a cyclic and reinvestment of wealth throughout the population, huge economic opportunity, and it diffuses the tension between the absurdly rich and the profoundly poor. There are two other laws I'll just give you, but I won't elaborate on those. Then maybe some other time, if we have a Bible study and I happen to be up here, you can ask them as questions. The law of no usury. The law of no usury. We already touched on that. You can't charge usury of an Israelite, a fellow Israelite. Again, another motivation for the Gentile nations to connect themselves to Israel. So that law will apply to them too. And then the other one is the law of long-term indentured servanthood. We touched on that, but there is more to the law. Now, it's fitting, I think, that we end with the Jubilee year in the sermon here, because we essentially have looked at God's bailout plan for economic bailout plan for mankind in the world tomorrow, based on the way of give, based on wonderful economic opportunity, and therefore it's based on freedom and liberty. Let's go to Luke chapter 4 for our final passage in conclusion. Luke 4 is actually quoted from Isaiah 61. Luke chapter 4. This is the theme passage of the ministry of Jesus Christ because he read it himself. We'll begin in verse 6. This is where Christ is tempted. The devil says to him, "All this authority I will give you and their glory." You know, he took him up onto a high mountain, looked at all the cities, all the nations that would exist, you know, anticipating the growth of the population. "All this authority I'll give you and their glory, for this has been delivered to me, and I will give it to whomever I wish. Therefore, if you will worship before me, it will be yours." And Christ said, "Get behind me, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only you shall serve." And then he went on with the temptation, but that was the particular point that I wanted to bring. And we come down to verse 14. "Then Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit to Galilee." See, he just fasted those 40 days and nights, and then Satan tempted him with the various temptations. And one of those temptations is that Christ could have the world now. That he could be the ruler of the world, and he could fix all the problems. Except one. Now, when everybody died, that would be it. They'd be dead. And there'd be no kingdom of God. Of course, he knew that. Bear in mind, Satan tries to be smarter than his creator. You can't do that. You can't be more powerful than the one who made you. You can't be smarter than the one who created you. And he seems to miss the point, so Christ took care of those temptations and said, sent Satan behind him, rebuked him, as we should in our lives, cast him away from us and ask God to help us to do that. And then look to the theme that Christ established. And Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit to Galilee, and news of him went out through all the surrounding region, and he taught in their synagogues and being glorified by all. So he came to Nazareth, his hometown, where he had been brought up. And as his custom was, because he was a Sabbath keeper, obviously, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up to read. And he was handed the book of the prophet Isaiah. And when he had opened the book, he found the place where it is written, "The Spirit of the Eternal is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, a recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, and proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord." It was a jubilee prophecy that when Christ proclaims liberty, it will be like the proclaiming of liberty that was done in the jubilee year. Economic opportunity, except that Christ here had something far greater than economic freedom and economic opportunity. It's the spiritual opportunity we all look forward to of being in the kingdom of God.